Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thanks, Marshall, and welcome to Off Script. Today, my guest is a great example of a local kid making good. My guest is actor Andrus Nichols, who's currently giving an incredible performance in a masterful production of Athol Fugard's A Lesson from Aloes at Hartford Stage. But way before that, Andrus cut her acting teeth right here in Robin Hood's listening area with the Goshen Players and productions at the Warner Theater in Torrington, with later training at Shakespeare and Company in Lenox and lots of gigs here and there. In 2012, Andrus co-founded Bedlam, the award-winning off-Broadway theater company. Her performance in the title role of St. Joan put the company on the map, and Andrus has since appeared to great reviews in its productions of Sense and Sensibility, Hamlet, and Twelfth Night, among others. Most recently, Andrus played Beatrice in the national tour of the award-winning revival of A View from the Bridge, directed by the internationally acclaimed director Ivo van Hove. Before her current role, now at Hartford Stage, in A Lesson from Aloes, under the direction of the award-winning Darko Trejnek. Welcome, Andrus.
Hi, thanks so much, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. Congratulations on your role as Gladys in Aloes. But before we talk about that, I just have to say, from Goshen Players to working with Ivo van Hove, who's probably the hottest director in the world, and Darko Trejnek, who's Tony Award-winning and arguably one of the most versatile directors in the world, that's a pretty remarkable journey.
Yes, I've been very lucky.
And very successful, too. I can't imagine it has just to do with luck.
No, I suppose not. But I do feel certainly lucky that I was able to get in the room with Darko. I'd never met Darko before this production. So it's, you get into the right room and you meet the right people, and then you find yourself in these incredible situations.
Before we get into Aloes, a little bit of background. You're from the area, right?
Yes.
Sort of, yeah.
I landed in the area for about 15 years or so. And I absolutely got my restart in acting in the community theater scene in the Northwest Corner.
That's great. Really remarkable. Okay, let's get right to Aloes. I saw it last Friday night, and it's really, really, it's a great play. It's written by Athol Fugard, who's a white South African, arguably, in my humble opinion, one of the best playwrights in the 20th century in the English-speaking world, who used apartheid as a backdrop of many of his plays that really made their mark on the international scene in the 1970s and the 1980s. This play was first presented at Yale Rep in 1978, but set the stage for us, Andrus. When the play opens, it's 1963. It's mm-hmm. the height of the government really cracking down on its apartheid regime. And Gladys, your character, is sitting inertly behind sunglasses in a backyard, and her husband, Pete, an Afrikaner, is tending his aloe collection. There's, to switch to metaphoric terms, a huge elephant in the backyard. And what's happened to Gladys? Can you take it from there?
Sure. In 1963, you're looking at a period of time, it's still about 30 years, of course, before the end of apartheid. And there was a big bus boycott in I believe it was 1957. And in the years that followed, things got extremely politically heated. And in the very early 60s, in 62 and 63 in particular, the government, there was a huge crackdown on any potential uprisings challenging the apartheid movement. And in 63, my understanding is that it was a moment in which I think the people involved in that cause really thought that it might be a lost cause. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there was a lot of dissipated energy in the movement. But so Gladys, her husband, Pete, who's been very politically active, Gladys, I would describe, and perhaps I'm being generous, as apolitical.
No, I think that's right. Yeah. She doesn't really want to get in this fight.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And there had been a series of raids of houses of people who had been part of the group opposing apartheid, of which her husband was one, and their house was raided, and her personal diaries were taken by the police in the middle of this raid. And for Gladys, who I think was quite fragile to begin with, that was a very violent transgression and really compromised her sense of stability and safety and her belief that her husband could protect her in what she sees, what she knows to be a violent world. And so that violation.
She calls it a rape, I think, or does she not? I'm not sure. Does she call it a rape?
She calls it a violation.
Violation.
My understanding of it is it is on that scale.
Yep.
I think
yep.
It certainly feels like a rape to her. And so she really started to kind of lose it after that. And by the time the play starts, she has gotten to the point where had been institutionalized for quite a while and undergone electroshock therapy.
Right.
At Ford England Clinic.
So, a little idea right now, in case you've just joined us, the guest is Andrus Nichols. She's giving an incredible performance as one of the leads of three characters in Athel Fugard's A Lesson for Aloes, now at the Hartford Stage until June 10th. Okay, so Gladys is sitting there. Her husband's contemplating his aloes collection, but she's a bucket full of resentments. So,
yeah.
Like, does she resent the fact that she's mentally ill? Does she resent her husband for getting involved in the cause? Does she resent the fact that she's stuck in South Africa? Does she even resent that she's married to this guy?
I think that for me, the things that have been the kind of hottest points for me are, I think she really resents that Pete has managed to, he's sort of come through it all okay. He's standing on, as she perceives it, to be very solid ground. He has not lost himself. He's really all right.
Compared to her.
You know, compared to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's not terrified of the world. He's not, doesn't seem to be paranoid. He seems to feel very safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's extremely jealous of how safe he feels.
Right.
And I also think that she is, Darko and I were talking about this at one point, if recovery is at all possible for Gladys, it would begin with getting out of South Africa. And there is absolutely no way that her husband is going to leave.
But what they do have in common, it's clear that she's jealous of him because he has an apparent security. But what they do have in common, I thought, watching the first act, which I thought was just incredible between the two of you, they share a sense of loss. I mean, Pete really he survives, but he suffers from the loss of his farm and from the loss of his cause and from, you know, which he had been introduced to by his friend Steve.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of those plays that all three of the characters have lost so much. And I think it's easy to immediately see how much Gladys has lost or how much Steve has lost. But as I've said to a few people, I think it's one of those plays where three blocks away from the theater, as you're walking out of it, you realize that it actually is Pete who's lost the most.
Mm-hmm.
He's lost absolutely everything.
To put that in context for people who've not yet seen the play, and if you haven't, I encourage you to make a trip to Hartford to see it, because I really don't think you can see a finer production with better acting of this great play than anywhere else you might, again. But just fill the audience in about Gladys and Pete are waiting for a dinner guest whose name is Steve, and give us some background on Steve so that the full conflict among the three makes sense.
So Steve is a black South African, and he is a huge political radical and activist, and has been a I think Pete would describe him as a best friend. It is interesting, though, because they don't, when you get into the second act and they talk to each other, you realize they were very allied politically, but they don't know that much about each other personally.
Well, they can't. I mean, they've been raised in a society that doesn't allow that.
Precisely. Yeah. But I do think that Steve is the other most important person in his life, other than his wife. But so Steve has been arrested. He was on a banning order for years, meaning that he couldn't work and he couldn't congregate with anybody else who was politically active. And he then ended up breaking that banning order and had somebody turned him in.
Well, a banning order, let's just clarify for people who might not be familiar, a banning order is if you've been arrested by the state for a legal law, the state then comes in and says, you can't go anywhere. You can't leave your house. And if we find you in any place you're not supposed to be, you're going to be imprisoned.
Correct.
Essentially, right.
Yes, it's house arrest, basically.
And
they were obviously on people who were on banning orders for political reasons, keeping a very close eye on those people. But he's ended up in jail for 6 months, and he's just been released from jail, and he is now about to emigrate to England with his whole family, with his wife and 4 kids. And he's leaving on the kind of permit that allows him to leave but never, ever come back to South Africa.
Right.
Which is hard for him. I think it's another thing Gladys is terribly jealous of.
Exactly.
But it's not what he wants. He really, South Africa is his home.
But getting back to Gladys, which is your role, she's jealous of her husband because of his apparent security. She's jealous of Steve because he's leaving South Africa, which she directly says in the play she would like to if she could, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But at the same time, as you mentioned, she's really doesn't want to get a dog in this fight. She's not politically oriented, but she's really not comfortable. You could almost make the case that she's a little bit anti-black herself.
That's why I said I thought I was being polite.
Yeah, because she says at one point in the play, if I stay out here in the sun, my brain will get brown, just like Steve's skin, which is a really derogatory kind of comparison. Yeah.
She says a lot of things that are absolutely derogatory and passively so, which is one of the ways in which I think she's so interestingly written, because it's the kind of, she just sort of exemplifies this sort of passive environmental racism.
There are brilliant moments in the play, particularly in the second act, where Gladys finally has this outburst, which is, I think, the high point of the dramatization. But as an actress, if you're trying to characterize or express or plainly act passive aggression, that's kind of hard, isn't it?
I think what's hard about it is that reading this play as an American woman in 2018, all of those things jump off the page at you when she, when he says, oh, I'm going to go on a boat. And she says, oh, one of the mail ships. I mean, you're going to cross in the cheapest way possible.
Of course.
With the mail.
Yeah.
There are a million things like that. The assumptions she makes about him are things that she says, the way that she responds to having his family there, that jump out at me. But I think you have, going into a play like this, you don't do it justice if you don't, you can't play passive aggression, really. I mean, I think you just have, I think though that is, she's a white woman in 1963 South Africa that has been raised in apartheid, in an incredibly segregated world.
But she her background is a little more privileged than her husband's. He came off the farm and lost it. But she comes from, if I interpreted it right, a British colonial family, right?
Yep, a British colonial family, or at least a South African family, but originally of British descent. And there is a big difference between those two communities, and especially there was in the 60s in South Africa. They speak with very different accents, and she doesn't speak Dutch. But certainly we know that she was from a family that, took summer vacations. So, I mean, she definitely had a different a more privileged life than her husband, more privileged upbringing.
If you're just joining us, the guest is Andras Nichols, one of the lead actors in a three-character fine play called A Lesson from Aloes, written originally in the 60s, but first premiered at Yale Rep in 1978, now at the Hartford Stage until June 10th. Andras, you talked about the dialects, which is really one of the keys to your performance, as well as Arion Bakare. Did I get that right?
Yep.
Yes, who plays Steve, and Randall Newsom, who plays
Pete. Right.
And the Randall, who plays Pete, is required to speak in an Afrikaner dialect. You speak in an African, South African dialect that clearly bespeaks of a British background. So
Absolutely.
You have a different accent. And then Steve, of course, incorporates both British, both Afrikaner, and of course, a lot of native tongue into his accent. Tell me about working with Ben Fury on getting all that right, because it's really remarkable what you guys achieved.
He is really incredible. One of the things that's great about him is that he immediately, I think he's worked with a lot of people who have had a lot of phonetics and a lot of people who have had none, like myself. So
back up just a minute now. Ben Fury was the dialect coach, and you're talking about people who've had phonetics?
Yes, who've had training in how to read phonetics and learn dialects by using those symbols.
Got it.
I didn't
okay.
go to a master's program
okay.
for acting, so I didn't have any of that work. Some people learn dialects that way, and others, there are those of us who learn purely by ear.
And you picked this whole thing up by ear?
I did, yes.
Wow.
That tends to be the way that I learn dialects, just sort of getting really steeped in the sounds of them and trying to listen to recordings of people speaking that way. And you have to be, even because I've spent a lot of time speaking with received pronunciation and in standard British, and it's not that different, but the palate it's flatter. The vowel mm-hmm. sounds are flatter, so it almost comes out a little more like the standard British that Claire Foy uses on The Crown. It's a little more dated and a little crisper. The vowels are flatter.
Mm, yeah.
So it's interesting. It's hard to learn something that's similar to something you know and yet completely different, to have it to sort of retrain the muscles of your mouth. And then even harder, of course, when you're on stage talking to somebody who's speaking in a completely different dialect.
And everybody's trying to hold their own. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Ben was wonderful. We did long individual sessions with him, and then he came to previews and run-throughs and would send us these MP3 files with notes, which were actually practically invaluable, because you just save them and then you have these recordings of how he's tweaking what mm-hmm. you're doing mm-hmm. To refer back to for weeks, which is great.
Hmm. What, getting back to Gladys, what was the most difficult scene, either for you to wrap around yourself or from a directorial point of view for Darko to really stage the way he wanted to see it, that all of you wanted to see it on the stage?
It's interesting. I think that the most difficult, rather than scene, but like a thing about Gladys that was difficult immediately, is that to try to understand and figure out and be able to have a good time with what happens to somebody when they've gone through that much electroshock. She changes directions really rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if she can go deep into a memory, and then she's wildly angry, and then she's suddenly okay. I mean, she changes direction so fast that I think that in a number of scenes in the play where that's happening, just figuring out where the hinges were for those
mm-hmm.
and how to fully go from 75 miles an hour straight ahead into 70 miles an hour in reverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and where and why and when that happens, and getting really specific about that. I think that was the biggest challenge the biggest challenge with her. I tend to play very stable people in other work that I've done lately. I mean, the last few shows I've done, I've been sort of the quiet thing around which
Beatrice is the Rock of Gibraltar in that household.
Eleanor in Sense and Sensibility is the only thing literally not spinning.
Yep.
And so it was a wildly fun experience for me to get to play the unpredictable one, if I could put it like that.
Yeah, no,
You get to just... It felt dangerous in a wonderful way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great role, and your performance is really superb about it. Let's dig a little deeper into Gladys. Do you think she really still loves Peter? Loves her husband? Or she just stuck?
I do.
Do you?
I think she loves him. I get the sense she's always sort of reminded me as the kind of... I mean, we know that her mother was terribly sick for 6 years. All we've heard about the father is from an early childhood memory. I think this mother that she had was, cold and awful and domineering and required a lot of her attention. We also know that Pete and Gladys have only been married 7 years.
Yeah.
So I sort of imagine that when Pete met her, she'd been taking care of her mother for the better part of her 20s and into her 30s. Her mother was still alive, but died shortly thereafter. And I think she was... I imagine her as a 35 or 37-year-old woman who was sort of, in some ways, 35 going on 15, going on 50.
Got it.
Do you know what I mean?
I got it. I see it perfectly, because when you present her, I mean, she's sitting stoically, inertly behind your sunglasses in the opening scene, but there's a weariness about her.
Yeah.
Just weary. I mean, she's really, really a tired soul.
Yeah, and then there's also this sort of adolescent thing about her in moments. I feel like, that she never got to... I don't think she was somebody who ever got to be a teenager or somebody in their early 20s and go on dates and go to the movies with friends. I think she was... There's part of her that reminds me of something out of like a Stephen King novel, where she was just kept at home with this horrible mother, feeding her Ovaltine and taking care of her and communicating with the doctors. From a very young age. I think what was so attractive to her about Pete was that he had this real purpose in his life. He was warm and talkative. And I definitely think Pete likes, look at him with his aloes and all of it. We've talked about this too. He likes projects. Mm-hmm. He likes feeling like he can take care of things. He's a nurturer.
Yep.
So I think it makes sense to me that he would see her and be attracted to the role he might play in her life.
Yep.
As a savior. And it makes sense to me that she was emboldened by this man who seemed to be so soft and caring and yet so strong and have such a clear sense of purpose. I think she got brave for just long enough to get out of that house and marry him.
And that was enough bravery for her lifetime. She didn't want to get stuck with all the rest of this stuff.
I think so. That was her big event. Yeah.
So that really brings me, I think, to the major question of the play, which is, it's a remarkable play because it's really not political. He uses this incredibly,
But the conversations are not political, really, are they? It does show you what happens. What I love about it is that it is actually in many ways an incredibly political play, but it does that by showing you what this size political injustice does to intimate relationships.
Or what it poses is, and I'd love your thoughts about this, is the ultimate question of the play, does the environment affect the survival of the individual, or does the individual determine their survival in whatever the environment?
Oh, that's good. I think the question of the, especially... when you look at the metaphor of the aloes,
yep.
I mean, certainly it is, Pete seems to be the only one who, he's not going to survive well.
But he'll make it. He'll make it. Yeah.
Darko says, I'd like to think that Pete's reward is that 30 years from now, maybe he's 85, but he has not left, and he will be there to see the end of apartheid.
Mm-hmm. And So a final question then, appropriately, would be, is your Gladys going to make it?
I don't think so. I don't know whether that means that she just kind of keeps going back and forth between home, between being a burden on Peter and back to the clinic, back and forth, and ends up going through so much electroshock that there's not much left of her.
Yep.
Or whether, I don't know, but I don't think so. I mean, not in, I don't.
But not to leave the play undone, you do leave it on a note of hope.
Do you think so?
I think so. I think so. I mean, well, I don't want to give away the ending, but she... Gladys says to him, I'll try. Basically, I'll try, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to use this next time. I'm going to try again.
Well, you have given an incredible performance. I thank you for coming on Off Script. Congratulations on it. It really is a marvelous play, and
your
performance is superb. Thank you for being our guest. Just a reminder to everyone, June 10th is the closing date, I think, Andrus, is that right?
That is correct.
So get to Hartford and see this. It's a wonderful production. And Andrus Nichols, thank you again, and congratulations on this, and congratulations on Bedlam and everything you've achieved there, too.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening. The program has been Off Script. We're underwritten by Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. I really appreciate you for listening in. Until the next time, as a dear departed friend of mine used to tell me all the time, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.